Nerds Amalgamated, a podcast that covers the latest events in science, pop culture, and gaming.
I'm the professor, aspiring game developer, sci-fi aficionado, and completely and undeniably a geek trying to take over the world. I'll be breaking down the news from tech to gaming.
I am the DJ, a humble nerd, a big weeb, and a watcher from the halls of the multiverse. Just kidding. Anyways, I'll be breaking down all things comics to movies to anime.
Join us and stay hydrated as we quench you with witty banter, unintentionally hilarious hot takes, and trivia more fun than a night at the pub, courtesy of Nerds Amalgamated.
Nerds Amalgamated, episode 196. Welcome to another episode of Nerds Amalgamated. I am the DJ.
And I'm the professor. Why are we so musical tonight, DJ?
I don't know. It's the first day of autumn. It's Friday, you know.
Tell that to the weather.
I know.
We've just had the hottest summer in Brisbane in decades.
Uh-huh.
Hasn't gone below 20 for months.
Yeah, I'm trying to get some sleep and I still can't get any sleep. So what have you been up to in those last few days? Besides trying to sleep and all.
I've been getting hyped up to go and see Dune Part 2.
Yep. Yeah, I've been hearing a lot of hype about it. Even apparently it has the highest ratings in IMDb since its release. So are you saying
it's higher rated than anything else? Because I find that hard to believe, because I looked it up and it's only got 9 on IMDb. Surely there's something that's a 9.1.
Hang a second. So yeah, here we go. It says a 9.1, and here is a full list of Villeneuve's rankings according to IMDb. Dune Part 2, 9.1.
Oh, okay. So it's just for, I'm going to butcher this pronunciation, but I did see a video on how to pronounce his name. Denis Villeneuve, I think.
Yeah, Villeneuve, yeah. Dune 2 is not only the highest rating film from the acclaimed filmmaker, but also the best reviewed film of the year. It's now tied for the third highest rating for a movie on the platform, trailing only Shawshank Redemption and The Godfather Part 2.
Wow.
By the way, Shawshank Redemption, 9.3. Godfather Part 2, 9.2. But there's a chance this could fluctuate, so...
Yeah, early days.
Yeah.
As of recording, it's only been out for like 2 days.
Also, before we continue on this episode, I've got a bit of housekeeping to deal with. So last week we were talking about Spirited Away and the characters being turned into pigs, and I mistakenly said that it was from the Jason and the Argonauts. I am sadly mistaken. That is not from Jason and the Argonauts. It's from the Odyssey.
Amateur.
I know.
How could you confuse your classical Greek adventures like that?
I'm mistaken on that one. And also another addendum. Remember that story about the spokesperson that said that they have better computers, and I said it was from Dell.
For context, the one who said that the Chinese computers are better, so they can run more cheats.
Yeah, it was actually from, it was that, I said Intel, that's actually from Dell. The person's actually from Dell. So I made that mistake too.
Two mistakes in what, 3 weeks?
Yep.
Unacceptable. You're fired.
Oh, come on, don't be as hard as Nintendo.
Your segues are terrible. You're also fired for that.
All right. Anyways, before we go to our lovely segue, our topics for this week, we'll be talking about Nintendo versus Yuzu, Marvel Rebuild, and Forest Bathing for Teens. So now on to our lovely segue. Professor, you've seen the story about Nintendo having a fight with Yuzu. What's that all about?
Well, basically, there's a fruit, and that fruit is in the citrus family, and it's endemic to Japan, and it's called yuzu. And Nintendo are suing yuzu.
So it's a fight against a fruit.
Well, it's named after a fruit. It's an emulator for playing Switch games.
Yeah, knowing Nintendo, they're very, very heavy-handed.
They are. So they're suing the developers of yuzu in the US with the intent of completely destroying them. They've requested for everything to be taken away from yuzu devs and given to Nintendo, including their hard drives.
Ouch. So what's the basis of them fighting against yuzu anyway?
Well, they've accused yuzu of violating the anti-circumvention and anti-trafficking provisions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is a 1997, I think, law in the US, specifically about copyright on computers. And while in the past there's been cases that suggest it's okay to have an emulator, those are 25 years old and might not be so relevant, especially with the way the US federal court is going at the moment, where they're re-legislating on a bunch of old cases. And it also doesn't completely clear them for cracking the encryption. Modern emulators require a BIOS or encryption key to be able to play the games, and those have to be taken from a physical console. So you can either take them from your own console, which in the Switch is possible if you have a certain model. They fixed the issue that allowed you to dump your own BIOS, or you can pirate one. Obviously, one of those is more legal than the other. Generally, the DMCA has a provision for backing up your games, and it does include a provision for reverse engineering, the DRM, on that, if you are backing up your own physical copies and not sharing them around. It's the sharing them around that tends to catch people there. So from what I understand of this, there's the two issues, circumventing the encryption and sharing the BIOS. Nintendo are now suing the developers and are using those as the keystones of their case.
But it's not really user's fault, though.
Why not?
I mean, they create the product, and they create the product, sure. But then them sharing part, they didn't tell the user didn't tell the people that were using the program to go, hey, share this around to your friends. Like, they didn't say that, did they?
So Nintendo suggests that yuzu are actually responsible for that by providing instructions on how to pirate.
Oh.
I haven't looked into the yuzu website myself, so I can't confirm whether they actually do include instructions. But they quote, detailed instructions to get it running with unlawful copies of Nintendo Switch games, and linking to websites to help users obtain and distribute prod.keys, which I am assuming are the encryption keys that Nintendo claims to own.
Okay, I'm at the quick start guide of yuzu, and there are some interesting table of contents, shall I say.
Okay, so that link that you've just included, the Switch hardware and software section of the yuzu wiki.
Yep.
Is about homebrew and hacking and hardware hacking, which also is something that isn't technically illegal, but I don't believe has been tested.
And the quick start guide?
So the quick start guide guides you through using a glitch to load a custom firmware, which then allows you to dump the keys that you need. So it looks like the process is basically to take an early model Switch, basically any produced before 2018, apparently it can work with other models, but is a bit more iffy. So you would enter into the RCM, which is a recovery mode, load in your custom firmware, download the decryption keys and firmware that you need to run yuzu, and it also includes instructions on dumping copies of games that you have purchased, which is technically legal as far as I'm aware. So I don't see anything here initially that looks suspicious to me. Although it does make me wonder, though, the decryption keys might be what is called an illegal number. So an illegal number is originally a term coined to describe the DCSS code which was an encryption key that would break DVD DRM.
Okay.
And it's an illegal number because it's a binary representation of the... Sorry, no, it's a hexadecimal, I think, representation of the code. And those are represented in numbers and letters in hexadecimal. You go 0 to 9, then A to F. It's hexadecimal because there's 16 units.
I have the Reddit link. Someone posted the legal number.
Okay, that's a Nintendo Switch key, it looks like. And yes, they are calling that an illegal number.
So, okay, from what you've been saying, so is this a frivolous lawsuit, or is there any merit onto this?
I'm worried that even if there isn't any merit to it, there will be a chilling effect on emulator developers. The case, I think, will probably go through, and Nintendo will probably win it because they have billions of dollars, and the people who develop Yuzu don't. So even if they could want to fight it, they probably can't.
Because Nintendo will win the war on attrition.
Because
these legal cases, it's a war on attrition, essentially.
Yeah, that's how a lot of these big cases tend to go, I think.
Yeah. But in terms of chilling effect, short term, what effects do you see would this chill be like in your point of from a game developer's perspective?
Well, Yuzu don't seem to be responding yet, but it's possible within the next few days we'll see them take their website down and go private on GitHub as a means of avoiding further issues. Although that probably isn't enough to get Nintendo to withdraw the case, so they might not bother. But the chilling effect would be that emulator developers would be too scared to create their own emulators because they might get sued, even if it is technically legal to create an emulator and the case comes down to the use of the keys.
And that's the short term, that's from your point of view.
Yeah.
What about... we've seen the shorts. How about long term?
Long term, we lose access to all of our games because the Switch hardware is obsolete. Nintendo stops producing it. We can no longer purchase new hardware. The games are then lost forever.
What was that? I remember a Project Archive you were talking about a while back that does like archive of old games. Not even them can save them?
Well, if you can dump the code. Sorry, dump the ROMs. But if you don't have an emulator, you can't play the game.
Yeah.
So at that point, you need to implement an emulator, whether you do that in software or hardware, which itself has legal issues.
And thus, this will make Nintendo look like a bigger bad guy than we already know they are.
Yeah, I love their games, but I'm not the biggest fan of them as a company. And that's saying something, because I hear that as a game developer, they treat their employees better than a lot of other companies in Japan do.
Yeah.
But it's the way they have absolutely no leeway for archiving games, for fan projects. They just stomp down on everything they can find.
I think from them, it's more of the, hey, you're ripping, it's more of the, hey, you're getting rich off us, and we demand a profit. And hence the lawyers.
That's how they got Gary Bowser, who is another hacker who made Nintendo Switch mod chips.
Yep.
And because he was selling them, they would come and sue him for the money he was making from selling the mod chips, because the mod chips allow piracy. The case has now ended with Gary Bowser being the fall guy for the entire organization. And in the position of having to repay like $14 billion or something.
$14.5 million damages owed to date.
And he is never going to be out from under that.
I'm reading the articles. To this day, he has only paid $175 of this. To this day.
Yeah, it looks like that article was just after he was released from prison.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't have had much of a chance to do that. The other thing is that in prison, the jobs that you work for can, in the US, I don't know about other countries, pay you below minimum wage.
Yep.
So that's a whole other issue, but he might just be in the position that he's only earned a tiny amount of money while being in jail. So that's why it's so low, and he's going to make more money now he's out, but it's unlikely he'll ever make $14 million. And that's before having his wages garnished. So if he was going to earn $14 million to pay back to Nintendo, they're probably taking 10% of everything he earns or something like that. So he'd need to earn $140 million in the rest of his life, which, not very likely.
Nope.
So I'm really hoping that the Yuzu devs don't get hit with such a huge damages. Although it does worry me that in May 2023, when Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom leaked, Yuzu's Patreon membership doubled.
Though I will say this, though, like the fallout from this has been interesting. Like, a lot of people have condemned Nintendo to be like, hey, Nintendo, what the hell? What the fuck are you doing? You're being too heavy-handed in this. Get the fuck out of here.
They don't care. Why would they care about people on the internet being mad? They only care if they lose money. And the only way they're losing money is if people stop buying Pokemon, and that's not going to happen.
I think it comes down to goodwill in terms of, hey, this. What we're seeing Nintendo doing is it will damage the goodwill of a lot of people that want to buy Nintendo products in the long run.
I don't know that that's a big enough percentage to make a difference, especially since Nintendo has no goodwill for fan projects anyway. Like, there's companies like Valve, where if you want to make a fan project, they will almost certainly let you go ahead with it. Most famously would be Black Mesa, a remake of Half-Life 1. They basically gave them permission to do whatever they want as long as they don't rip off any assets, and they even let them sell it on Steam.
And they finished that game after how long it was?
Oh, like a decade.
Yeah.
Longer than a decade. Yeah, the first release was 2012. The full release was 2020. And they started developing it in 2004.
Could you see? I saw one of the remarks in that article. They were saying that, oh, this lawsuit will curb piracy. Do you reckon that's... I think that's cap.
You'll never stop piracy.
Yeah, you'll never stop. It's cap. Like, this being heavy-handed, you expect people to fall in line? No, it's not going to happen. People still will do piracy.
I'm a firm believer in Gabe Newell's proclamation that piracy is a service problem. Basically, if you make it easy and reasonably priced for someone to buy your games, they will buy them. There's a certain fraction of people who would pirate anyway, and you can't do anything about them. But by making more and more hoops to jump through, you're just hurting your chances of getting someone to buy the game rather than pirate.
What's also going to be interesting is how many game companies are we... Like, if Nintendo does this, it's only going to be a matter of time before other game companies will see, go, hey, if Nintendo can do that, why don't we try that out and see how much money we can get out with the emulators?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see Sony go after, I can never remember the name, RPS CSX3 or something. It's a really bad name. Because I was reading that that emulator uses the same sort of key structure as Yuzu does. So you have to dump your own keys.
There is the EPSXe OpenGL plugin, RetroArch.
RetroArch is actually something completely different. It's a way to use emulators. It's like Steam for emulators. It's not an emulator itself.
Okay. I mean, hell, Nintendo could go.
Here we go. RPCS3 is a PlayStation 3 emulator.
Okay.
And then they have RPCS4, and I'm assuming RPCS5. No, PCSX5.
Yeah, open season for game companies to go after other emulators to, if Nintendo succeeds in this, it'll be open season.
Yeah, it would be.
Okay, here's a crazy idea, though. Could you see emulator companies go into the dark web if it becomes too much?
Absolutely. like I said, you can't stop piracy. There will be a way to distribute pirated content. If that has to go into the dark web, then it will go into the dark web. And you've effectively just swept the rug over it.
Oh, damn. Yeah, but the problem with if you want to go to the dark web, isn't it, like, dangerous for your PC? Like, you have to get, like, multiple PC VPNs and antivirus guides just to get into it?
Yeah, it's risky, but not the end of the world. And if you're going to a known site through the dark web, then you're pretty safe. So you've just got to get your hands on the address of a legitimate site, and that'll get passed around somehow.
So you'll be watching this with open eyes, I'm assuming, Professor?
Yes, I will be following it closely.
So let's go to our next... Shall we go to our next topic?
Go on.
All right. So I was initially wanting to talk about Mary Poppins and how they've changed the ratings, but an interesting article landed on my lap this week, and it was talking about Marvel and how they're going to rebuild itself after a couple of disasters, aka Madam Web.
They've had a bunch of underperforming movies in the last few years,
and
they've got the problem of their lead villain being fired.
Oh yeah, he was fired. Although there have been claims going around now that the lead actor was is subject to being changed because of how bad the movie that he was in was rated poorly and not many people watched it, essentially. But yeah, it was not only the movies but also the TV shows that got that were poorly performing as well. So now Marvel has decided that we're going to be doing some changes around itself. And while they were doing some changes, a couple of interesting things have happened, such as the Deadpool and Wolverine Super Bowl trailer that came out, which became the most watched trailer of all time, 365 million views. And then there was the Marvels, which became the lowest grossing MCU movie, hitting 206 million globally. Then there was the unveiling of the Fantastic Four with Pedro Pascal, Vanessa Kirby, Ebon Moss Bachrach, and Joseph Quinn. And then a day later, the Marvel launched the trailer for the X-Men 97 cartoon, a revival of the 1990s cartoon series, which debuts in March. The trailer set an internal Disney record as the biggest launch for an animated series, ahead of other shows such as What If and any Star Wars series, animated-wise.
So it's nostalgia bait.
Pretty much. Now, the reason why all these stunts were done, it was because of Kevin Feige's plan to recalibrate the creative direction behind the scenes. So one such act was early in February, one of the spin-offs for WandaVision, Agatha Darkhold Diaries. They've done some reshoots. Now, normally the company would budget 5 days of reshoots into schedule, but the studio completed the work in just one day.
So maybe they're starting to come out of that slump.
Hopefully. Then the studio also hired Eric Pearson to polish the script for Fantastic Four, which will be shooting this summer in London. Eric Pearson is the company stalwart who worked on Thor Ragnarok and Black Widow, and has a reputation.
Oh dear!
I know. Oh, Ragnarok.
Weren't particularly well received movies, though.
No, Ragnarok was well received. Black Widow wasn't. Yeah, you're talking about Thor: Love and Thunder. That wasn't well received. That was not well received.
I thought Ragnarok wasn't as bad as Love and Thunder, but a lot of people didn't like it. Huh. As my friend called it, Bore Ragnarok.
Ouch. So Pearson has a reputation of taking projects over the finishing line. The stakes for that are high, as the studio is searching for characters and actors who can carry its universe forward after the exit of Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Evans. I don't think that's going to happen. No one cannot carry the universe as good as Robert Downey and Chris Evans. No one. And then Marvel also hired Joanne Carlo, the showrunner of the FX series The Bear, to work on the Thunderbolts, aka not Suicide Squad, and the film.
Is that what the Thunderbolts are? Are they another group of villains sent on secret missions?
Yep. Boom. It's Marvel's answer to the Suicide Squad, essentially. So the film is set to begin shooting in Atlanta. Her hiring adds flair of prestige to the project, which stars Florence Pugh. And according to sources who has read previous drafts of the script, centers on villains and antiheroes going on a mission that was supposed to end with their deaths.
What is this? Some kind of Suicide Squad?
Oh boy! So, what else has happened? Marvel is also cleaning up the mess that Jonathan Majors has created with his high-profile court case. They dropped Majors hours after the conviction and rewriting those movies. The first of the new Avengers movies was due in 2026. Was initially titled Avengers: The Kang Dynasty, but we'll give a new title to remove the character's name. Though sources say that even before Majors' conviction, the studio was making moves to minimize the character after Quantumania grossing $476 million.
I'm surprised they didn't just recast him because of the whole multiverse thing.
But it'd be a pretty hard sell to try and, like...
I don't think so.
Okay.
How a multiverse works, right?
It'd be the same character, but different faces, essentially.
Yeah. I don't see why that would be a hard sell. As long as they pick someone good to play him, or her, they could even do a gender flip and blame it on the multiverse.
Yeah, I could see that. I can see it happen, but, like, I could see a female lead of the Council of the Kangs just doing the Kang Dynasty. That would have been a great idea. Just do a female Kang. But, yeah, I don't know. Some people are saying Doctor Doom might be the lead villain. Others are saying someone else, so we don't know. But aside from the movie side, the TV side, it's also getting a bit of a change. With greater control from the showrunners, a move made after the critical failure of the Secret Invasion TV show, which sidelined Carl Bradstreet after a year, with various creative factions vying for influence in its wake. They're also basically saying the writer's strike also did the writer's strike did a whole damage with the Marvel films. And what's happening is the source concludes by saying they're not going to give up. They just want to make something great, essentially.
Well, they could stop pumping out shit.
See,
that's my big complaint about Marvel. There's too much of it.
It's not only that. I agree with you. There is too much of it.
It's a full-time job.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, I agree. I agree. It's a full-time job. But here's the problem with me when it comes to Marvel. It's too much CGI and not good writing. The CGI. Okay, cool. It's a good distraction, but I want a proper story.
Yeah, you're not gonna get that out of blockbuster movies. They're not there to tell a good story.
Nah,
they're there to get butts in seats.
Yeah, yeah. Well, unfortunately, now audiences are starting to catch up to the fact that, hey, we're not gullible idiots. We know what you're trying to do. I mean, look at the performances of the Marvels and Madame Web, for example. They're clear examples of what the audiences are trying to tell you, Disney. Hey, your shows are getting crappier by the release. Give us some good content. And I'm hoping that the Deadpool Wolverine movie will try and help we'll try and regain some faith with the audience, hopefully. But anyways, that's my rousing speech over.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that we need more Marvel. It's okay to let things end.
Interestingly, what you said there, Bob Iger also said that same thing too. He said, some of our studios have lost focus, so the first step that we've taken is to reduce the volume. We've reduced output, particularly at Marvel. The films you're making can be even better.
I'm agreeing with Bob Iger. Something is very wrong with the universe.
Okay, Professor. Who are you? And are you Bob Iger in disguise?
I hope not. I like being me.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Anyways, let's go on to our next topic before we start bashing more Marvel. This topic, Professor, you've got here, it's about forest bathing.
Yes, the feel of the wind in your hair, the leaves rustling in the trees. Turns out it's good for your mental health. And even having small urban forests have a positive outcome on you.
Wait, whatever happened to just having a park there? Isn't that the same thing?
Well, it could be a park, it could be a lake, could be basically any sort of green space. It reduces stress, and they've managed to quantify just how much that affects your anxiety. And you don't even need a huge amount of time. They have an example where standing at and looking at a lake for 2 or 3 minutes, the anxiousness scale decreased by 9%. And compared to a busy downtown location, that's a huge decrease. So that's one reason why I'm quite happy with what they're doing in Brisbane at the moment, turning the Victoria Park, Barambin area back into an urban forest.
See, understand where they're coming from in terms of we need forests and green areas to try and deal with the chaos of the concrete jungle. But then you have to also take into account the population is increasing.
That's why we need higher density residential areas. And we need to break them up with green space. Rather than having urban sprawl, we should be collecting into hubs and having green space in between.
Thing you have to also have to consider is who is going to maintain this? Is it going to be your local council, or is it going to be a state government thing, or is it going to be a federal government thing? If that's going to be another problem you have to consider.
Your local council with funding from the state and federal governments. Damn, I should have been a politician.
Vote one for the professor. He will help you through the darkest days and send you to the brightest of nights. Damn it, I messed up the tagline.
Yeah, I'm not going to hire you as my campaign manager if that's what you're going for.
No, I was actually aiming for the speechwriter. Okay, the other thing you also have to consider is when it comes to the forest bathing element to this, you also have to consider like how many homeless people are we going to see at a park? Because there are a lot of homeless people at a park.
Yeah, that's a difficulty that can be helped by increasing social services and lowering the price of housing by building higher density units.
You really should have been a politician. You really should have. It's an interesting part. The study found that nature motifs or patterns on buildings, natural sites in urban environments such as lakes and public activity parks, and landscape elements like gardens and trees enhance positive experiences for youth. While these characteristics are unique to adolescents, they might be interpreted differently from adults who pursue other activities. For example, adults might be more likely to walk or run in green spaces where youth would likely to skateboard or hang out.
Yeah, so people in different groups use areas differently. I don't think we need a scientist to tell us that one.
Uh-huh. The question is going to be how much space are we going to give the adults and how much space are we going to give the kids? Because that's always that's the difficult part, finding that balance.
Yeah, this politics thing is too hard.
Yep. The study author also said that teens are frequently excluded from any kinds of decisions about the cities they live in. It is important to get their opinions and quantify their experiences because childhood experiences influence many long-term health and disease outcomes.
Yeah, that makes sense. teens are in the awkward spot where they want to get away from their childhood homes and experiences. They want to, they're old enough to be independent and go out and hang out in a park, but there's also not as many places for teenagers to hang out.
Not to mention the same teenagers will go, does this Wi-Fi work here?
Okay, so have you gone from using Zoomer terminology to being a full boomer?
Yes. I mean, I agree with you there, though, in terms of they are frequently excluded from any decision makings in this in town planning. But then again, the problem is going to be like, how many percent of teenagers are there versus how many percent of adults are there in the city's population?
Well, they're not saying let the teenagers run the place. They're just saying take them into account.
Okay, I got a question for you though, Professor. Say you are a town planner and you want to revitalize Brisbane City, for example. What would you want to add more of?
Ooh, better public transport.
Oh, come on, really? Better public transport as it is?
Yeah, our public transport's not that great. It does the job, but it's got a lot of problems.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the busways are a great idea. They make it really easy for me to get to work. It's actually faster for me to take the bus to work than it is to drive most days. I think one of the key things in public transport is having it be separated from the roads. So busways and bus lanes, because then you don't have them getting bogged down in traffic.
Hmm. I think when it comes to public transport, and this may sound like a bit of a radical idea, they should bring back the damn trams.
Yes, bring back the trams.
I mean, look at Sydney and look at Gold Coast, for example. They've brought back the lovely trains and into the city, and it does wonders. Like, you don't even get that here.
We had that here. For some reason, they ripped them all up. Actually, apparently the tracks are still there underneath the roads.
Huh.
Apparently it was cheaper to build over them than it was to pull them up. So I wonder how hard it would be to just rip up the road and return the lane to tram usage.
It will be a very costly exercise in the current price range.
Yeah.
Okay, what else would you want to do to revitalize Brisbane City? Besides public transport?
Well, on the public transport front, I'd like a high-speed link between Brisbane, the Sunshine Coast, Brisbane and Ipswich, Brisbane and the Gold Coast. And then I'd like to have higher density development so that we could cluster into the cities and move between them easily and not have to demolish all of the green space in between.
I'll sound like the whiny news reporter here. Sure, Professor. How would you fund all this incentives?
I don't know. I've never looked at the economics of it.
Fair enough.
But rezoning areas is cheap, and as I understand it, would just lead to developers coming in and building up higher. You wouldn't have to dump a whole bunch of money into that, so that's a good start. And the higher density you are, the better public transport works, and the closer you can have things like shopping centres and green space to your place of residence.
Have to come down to how high the population is growing, or how fast. I mean,
yeah, they're already having trouble building enough houses,
yeah,
which is another reason for higher density development.
So, shall we move?
I'm just excited for the solar punk future.
Oh yeah! Oh yeah!
Yes, green energy, green spaces.
You do public realize
transport.
You do realize that's like a pipe dream at this current stage, right?
Oh, I do. I know the planet's going to burn.
Shall we move on?
Yes, let's move on.
before we start having more pipe dreams in our midst. All right, anyways, so for our shout-out, we have our messed up moment in nerddom number 5. And for this one, it is called Project Pluto. And it's basically a United States government program to develop nuclear-powered ramjet engines for using cruise missiles. Two experiment engines were tested at the Nevada test site in 1961 and 1964, respectively.
Yeah, the scary part of this is that they're unshielded reactors traveling at supersonic speeds just above the ground. So they send you death, they spray you with radiation, and they drop a bomb on you.
So it's a triple whammy.
Yep.
Ouch. I was reading about this, and the funny thing is, they were trying to find an alternative to the ICBMs, the Intercontinental Ballistic Missile.
Yeah, let's not just kill the target. Let's kill everything on the way to the target.
I saw this bit. This bit hit me. Okay, so they said, despite the successful test, the Department of Defense, the sponsor of the Pluto project, had second thoughts. The weapon was considered, and I quote, too provocative, and it was believed it would compel the Soviets to construct a similar device.
Yeah, well, you know how that's gone. They likely have one now. Because a couple of years ago, there was a radioactive explosion in a test site. And they're like, oh, yeah, that was just our radioactive, radiation-powered missile. And everyone's just like, you're like, what?
Oh. So the intercontinental ballistic technology has proven to be more available than previously thought, reducing the need for such highly capable cruise missiles. It adds several advantages, such as less ground support and maintenance, can be launched in minutes instead of several hours, and so was less vulnerable to nuclear first strike. And it also traveled to its target faster and less vulnerable to inception by Soviet air defenses. The main advantage of the SLAM, for the nuclear one, was its ability to carry a larger payload, but the value of this was diminished by improvements in nuclear weapon design, which made them smaller and lighter, and subsequent development of nuclear multiple warhead capabilities of intercontinental ballistic missiles. I bet your money North Korea has one as well.
Nah, North Korea aren't that great at flinging stuff. And we'd know if they had one because they need to test it in the air. And someone would notice that.
Yep.
Like this this test, the Tory engine that they tested in the US.
Yeah.
Used massive air tanks.
Oh.
And was fixed in place on the ground. Because part of the design of a ramjet, you basically get going super fast. So they would have attached a rocket to it to launch it to its operating speed and then rely on the compression of the air coming into the nozzles of the engine. So that requires a massive test site and a significant, if they were going to test it in the air, a significant, they'd be launching basically a nuclear bomb over their own people.
Oh, yeah.
Because testing it over anyone else would be counted as an act of aggression.
And the cleanup would be a really hellish cleanup.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting thing for you. On the 1st of July 1964, 7 years and 6 months after it started, Project Pluto was cancelled. Merkel hosted a celebratory dinner at a nearby country club for project participants where slam Tytacs and bottles of Pluto, in quotations, mineral water, were given away as souvenirs. At its peak, Project Pluto had employed around 350 people and 100 at Livermore and 100 at Site 401, and the total amount spent was $260 billion, which is equivalent to $1,885 million in 2022. That's a spicy meatball.
Very spicy. Yet another example of wild Cold War scientists who were basically like, you know what? Just because we can doesn't mean we shouldn't.
All right. Anyways, on to our wacky movie. And this wacky movie is very wacky. So on the 28th of February 1992, Memoirs of an Invisible Man premiered. And this was directed by John Carpenter and included a star cast of Chevy Chase, Daryl Hannah, and Sam Neill. And here's the plot. Nick Holloway is made invisible during an accident when Jenkins finds out about Nick. He was set to recruit him into the world of espionage, seeing the potential for an invisible CIA agent. When Alice Munro falls in love with Nick, they are forced to flee the attention of Jenkins. Nick also has the problem of living invisibly whilst trying to find a cure. Now, to this film's credit, the good folks of the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films gave the film an incredible 4 nominations in the 1993 Saturn Awards in the categories of Best Special Effects, Best Supporting Actor, Best Actor, and Best Science Fiction Film. But this movie had a lot of drama involved in the production and in the production before and after. So, in 1986, Henry F. Sank's memoirs of the Invisible Man was still unfinished, while Hollywood agent William Morris gave it to Chevy Chase to read. The actor instantly got interested, which led to a bidding war among studios. Warner Brothers paid $1.35 million for the film rights. William Goldman was assigned to write the screenplay in the 1980s, by which Ivan Reitman was attached to direct it. It was Goldman's first screenplay after what he called his leper period. When he was in no demand to write scripts, he attributes his comeback to being represented by the CAA.
And who are the CAA?
I think it's the California Actors Association or something like that. Corporate Artist Agency. There we go.
You said corporate. You meant to say creative artists.
Ah, my mistake. The project was a vanity project shepherded by Chase through the studio. This film was billed as a Cornelius Productions. Cornelius was Chevy Chase's real first name. He wanted to make a film about loneliness of invisibility, intending the film to be a bridge into less comedic roles. Goldman did 3 script drafts of the script, and Warner was prepared to greenlight the film. Ivan Reitman was originally set to direct the film, but when he and Chevy Chase constantly had heated arguments over the film's tone, Reitman refused to work with Chase and demanded the studio choose either him or Chase. They chose Chase. Goldman also left the project saying, "I'm too old and too rich for this shit." He later said that Mark Canton, the head of the studio, did not pay the writer for all his work, causing Goldman to initiate a lawsuit against him. An alternate ending to the film showed Alice giving birth to an invisible child. Carpenter later stated that this ending was cut because Warner Brothers was worried that about the audience would react to an invisible baby as if it were a freak, an unfortunate and innocent diabolical child. Warner Brothers is in the business of making audience-friendly, non-challenging movies. I was aware of this when I signed on, so I guess I shouldn't complain. Still, we could have released a somewhat stronger version of the picture, but it's a big studio film and it suffered from what a lot of studio movies suffer from, the audience preview process, when you cut every high and low point and you make it very bland. I don't think the Warner Bros. Have learned that lesson ever since.
Nope. That reminds me of the Dune movies, changing the word jihad for crusade because jihad is not the best association these days.
Wait, did that actually happen?
Yeah.
Interesting.
The Fremen in the books are very clearly descended from Arabic-speaking people.
Okay.
And in the movie, I was reading an article about it today. In the movie, they've come up with their own situation for it because they didn't want the controversy of having used words like jihad and having obviously Muslim-descended people in a world in which Muslim-descended people aren't seen that great.
Carpenter would go on to say that the production of this film was troubling and vigorous. Besides battling studios, executives, Carpenter also claimed Chevy Chase and Hannah were the stuff of nightmares and impossible to direct. In particular, Chevy Chase would often refuse to wear his special effects makeup and remove it prematurely, ruining a day's worth of filming. He even stated that this was his least favorite of all films he directed, and is the film that he hates thinking about the most. One reason was because of the studio interference, and also Chevy Chase's was a director's worst nightmare and nearly impossible to direct, saying the same about Daryl Hannah, that according to Carpenter, Chase would complain nonstop about the film's tone and hated wearing the special makeup effects. And at one point, Carpenter broke a clipboard in half over his knee in a fit of rage when Chase removed this makeup mid-take. Carpenter said that Chase and Hannah were immune to any punishment from the studio and they knew it. So they walked all over me and everyone else on set and essentially told us we would be replaced if they had any problems with them. It was like working with your boss's snooty children who would tattle on you if you didn't bend to their every will. Despite this, Carpenter ended up bonding and seeking comfort in Sam Neill over the troubling production, and the two became close friends, with Neill agreeing to work with Carpenter again in The Mouth of Madness. This was Carpenter's first film in the 1990s, after his and also his first major studio film since Big Trouble in Little China. The reason he had not done so was due to the fact that he had received a low studio interference on that film and felt restrained to do the films he would have liked independently. Prince of Darkness and They Live were made during that time independently. And finally, the studio by Shirley Walker was the first major Hollywood studio picture with a complete orchestral score written by a woman. Oh, and I forgot to add in two more interesting trivia to this film. William Goldman, who originally wrote this draft of screenplay, even though he received credit for it, he claims to have never seen the film and thus cannot say for sure how much of his material is actually in the film. And John Carpenter in 2023 said this in reception to the movie. It gave me a chance to make a quasi-serious film, but Chevy Chase, Sam Neill, who I love and have a long-term friendship with, and Warner Brothers, I've worked for them, and it was pleasant. No, it was not pleasant at all. I'm lying to you. It was a horror show. I really wanted to quit the business after that movie. God, I don't want to talk about why, but let's just say there were personalities on that film. He shall not be named who needs to be killed. No, that's terrible. He needs to be set on fire. No. Anyway, it's all fine. I survived it.
Okay, then.
Man, John Carpenter. So, what's your plans for the next few days, Professor?
Going to see Dune.
Oh, you lucky man. IMAX?
I don't know yet.
Oh, IMAX it. Just watch it on IMAX. It's more worthwhile watching it on IMAX than on your standard movie theater.
You sound like an IMAX salesman.
I know. I love the IMAX. What am I doing? I'm going to continue watching the Last Airbender series. I know I've said it last week. I was want to watch it. I started watching it, then I stopped, and I'm going to continue watching it. And yeah, it's a painful experience. So pray for my soul. But anyways, that's all we have for this week. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, X. Where else can they find us, Professor?
You mean Twitter?
Yes, Twitter.
That's not canon.com, where you can find an archive of our old episodes, and anywhere you can get podcasts.
And YouTube. Don't forget YouTube, where we have our nerdy bits. Anyways, that's all we have for this week. Stay happy, stay nerdy. See you guys.
Look after yourselves and stay hydrated. Here we go.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.